So I guess we can start. It's 3 o'clock here. So today's sutta is called the Vamika Sutta. It's translated here as the Anthill here. And the reason I have chosen this sutta is simply because I don't think it has been done before here. And we have done so many suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya that the ones that are left are kind of slightly obscure and slightly unusual suttas. So this one may look a bit, it looks kind of short, it's much shorter, and it's a set of verses, a set of kind of slightly cryptic sayings, which then are explained by the Buddha afterwards. And it's the sutta that you will very rarely hear, so for that reason it might be interesting in itself. But it is not, you know, some of the things in here are a little bit obscure and not very clear exactly what they mean. So it's we'll see what happens as we go through this. Majjhima number 23 here. Yeah, and the Vamika Sutta 23 here. So we'll see what happens as we go through this. One thing straight away is that some people have said that anthill should perhaps instead be termite mound. Because there is, towards the very end of the sutta, we will see that there is a snake living in this anthill termite mound. And apparently snakes don't live in anthills, but they can live in termite mounds, apparently. So there is an argument here that actually means a termite mound rather than anthill. So anyway, let's see. I'm not sure how much difference that makes, but see how we go along. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Samadhi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Kumara Kassapa was living in the Blind Men's Grove. Then, when the night was well advanced, a certain deity of beautiful appearance, who illuminated the whole of the Blind Men's Grove, approached the Venerable Kumara Kassapa and stood to one side. So standing, the deity said this to him. So we are now in Savatthi, which of course is one of the main places where the Buddha resided. This is the place where he stayed the most, according to the suttas. He spent the most rains retreats in this place. And Anathapindika's Park is the monastery given by Anathapindika, which was situated just outside of the city of Savatthi. This is the kingdom of Kosala, one of the two largest kingdoms in India at that particular time. It was kind of feuding with Magadha, which was the other large kingdom. There was near the Anathapindika's monastery, there was a grove called the Blind Man's Grove, not far away from there, same area. And that's where Venerable Kumara Kassapa was staying. Kumara means like a boy, basically. And Kassapa is a near family name, so almost like the boy Kassapa is the meaning of is the meaning of his name. And he is not very well known in the suttas. He doesn't really occur in many places. He occurs here, and he occurs also in one other sutta in the Digha Nikaya called the Payasi Sutta, which is a nice sutta about experiments that someone does to find out whether there is a soul or not. And kind of some brutal experiments, like sealing someone into a jar and then heating the jar until the person dies, and then when they open the jar to see if the soul escapes or not, or killing someone and weighing them beforehand or afterwards to see if they weigh more or less before or after they're dead, so they can weigh the soul, right? This kind of experiments. That was also Kumara Kassapa who used these symbols. So he occurs in a couple of fairly obscure suttas, but they are kind of the other one, at least Payasa, is good fun, and this one here is also a bit unusual. Anyway, so that's always a sign that if you see unusual things, it's always a sign that the sutta itself might be a bit unusual as well. So then the deity comes, and the deity approaches him, and the deity then comes and speaks these verses to him that are coming afterwards. And of course, one of the questions that arises in this kind of situation is, when a deity comes and speaks a number of verses to you, and what does that mean? Does that mean are we supposed to take that literally, that the deity actually comes and speaks verses to a monk? Is that what happened? Or is that some kind of metaphor for something else going on behind that you know, nobody really knows exactly what it was, perhaps. So they say that it was a deity who approached this monk. And this is actually an interesting question. It's very hard to know whether this is really actually happening or whether it's used in a metaphorical sense. And both are really possible. But if it is to be looked at in a metaphorical sense, then it might be, for example, that these verses were perhaps things that were circulating at the time in Indian society, and that to sort of give them an origin, they would then say that it came from a deity. And you will notice here that, and the reason for that may be to give them more authority, right? If they were just circulating among the ordinary population of India, then it's kind of random, nobody really knows what they were. But if they came from a deity, it's a bit more like they have a real authority to them because they came from something that is kind of a bit more awe-inspiring. If an ordinary person heard it was from a deity, they'd be like, wow, okay, must be important in that case. If they heard it was just circulating among certain people, it might not have been very interesting or inspiring for people. So that's one possibility that it's just used in this metaphorical sense. And very often when you see this interaction between the deities and the people in the suttas in this way, it is very rare to see that in the actual text which the Buddha himself speaks, right? Suttas can often be divided into two aspects. One is the actual sutta, thing which is delivered by the Buddha or delivered by a monk or a nun. And then there is the narrative. The narrative is like the context, right? And the first two paragraphs here are like the narrative part. Even what comes afterwards might be called narrative because it's not part of what the Buddha says. But certainly two paragraphs here are narrative. They obviously have been added afterwards, right? Somebody has said, well, what, you know, where did this happen? What kind of went on? So while you listen to the sutta, that's the kind of you take on board the actual text. And afterwards, somebody says, well, we need a bit of context. We put a narrative in there. And this is this is where the idea of the deity is in the narrative. And that is, of course, happened after, much probably quite a bit later. So it is much more uncertain whether that information is reliable or not. And that's why it is acceptable to ask the question whether it is used metaphorically or it actually happened literally, the way it says here. Yes, sir. Many times, yeah. It's a very common phenomenon in the suttas. It's true, yeah. It's true. It is very powerful, and I think again, it, you know, when you have this idea of something powerful happening, it lends kind of certain authority to the text which comes afterwards, you know. So it's very hard to know. I think whether it. I mean, it's not something that it's very hard for us to relate to a deity coming down and telling you a verse. I mean, it's not something that happens every day, right? It's fairly kind of unusual, and because it is so unusual, it's hard to know whether these things actually happened or not. It seems kind of, because it is very hard to relate to directly. So because of that, I think it's okay to kind of not to take these things, you know, on faith and confidence. It must have been this way. It's good to kind of have it, I think, a slightly open mind about these things. So yeah. Okay. Anyway, so let's now see what this deity said. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Please. Yeah. I would say that among Buddhists, it probably is accepted, generally speaking, that these things did happen. Yeah, and it can be seen. Not sure. Maybe it can be seen with the physical eye as well. I'm not sure. I mean, sometimes they talk about the devas transforming themselves, you know, as they come down and taking on a physical form, you know, so they might actually be visible to the naked eye. Yeah. It's, yeah. Yes.
Mm. Ah, ja.
Yeah. But things are complicated in Buddhism, because in Buddhism obviously there is an acceptance that there are, you know, realms without these kind of beings. So the beings themselves are kind of already accepted, and they're part of the whole Buddhist idea that if you develop a mental state which is roughly equivalent to those beings, you will be reborn in that state, right? So they in a sense, they're already accepted as beings. In many of these other mythologies, whether the beings actually exist or not is much more uncertain. But for us, because they exist, it actually starts to become plausible that they might also come down. That's why it is so hard to make the decision there. Whereas, you know, whether Zeus and Apollo and these gods actually existed, that's kind of maybe they did, but it's kind of much more mythological in those places. Here, it is quite specifically said that these beings, are there in a sense, at least in one way. Yeah, that's maybe a good way of looking at it. It's like a frequency, a different frequency, exactly. And you have to tune into the frequency, and you can kind of, yeah. I think that's a metaphor that Bhikkhu Bodhi uses. Okay, so this is what this deity says to the monk. Bhikkhu, this anthill fumes by night and flames by day. Thus spoke the Brahmin, delve with the knife, thou wise one. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw a bar, oh venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahmin. It's a bit cryptic, right? So we'll see soon what all this means, because you may think this is really strange. So don't despair straight away, and just hold on, and we'll see what it means afterwards. Thus spoke the Brahmin, throw out the bar, delve with the knife, thou wise one. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw a toad, oh venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahmin, throw out the toad, delve with a knife, thou wise one. Delving with a knife, the wise one saw a fork, oh venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahmin, throw out the fork, delve with a knife, thou wise one. Delving with a knife, the wise one saw a sieve, oh venerable sir. It's a strange anthill. Thus spoke the Brahmin, throw out the sieve, delve with a knife, thou wise one. Delving with a knife, the wise one saw a tortoise, oh venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahmin, throw out the tortoise, delve with a knife, thou wise one. Delving with a knife, the wise one saw an axe and block, oh venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahmin, throw out the axe and block, delve with a knife, thou wise one. Delving with a knife, the wise one saw a piece of meat, oh venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahmin, throw out the piece of meat, delve with a knife, thou wise one. Delving with a knife, the wise one saw a naga serpent, like a dragon, oh venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahmin, leave the dragon, do not harm the dragon, honor the dragon serpent, or the naga serpent. Bhikkhu, you should go to the Blessed One and ask him about this riddle. As the Blessed One tells you, so you should remember it. Bhikkhu, other than the Tathagata or a disciple of the Tathagata, one who has learned it from them, I see no one in this world with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, whose explanation of this riddle might satisfy the mind. This is what was said by the Blessed One, by the deity, who thereupon vanished at once. So this is a kind of standard setup you see in the suttas. You see somebody saying something which is slightly unsure and uncertain, something which might be understood in many ways. And then the monk or the nun or whoever might go to the Buddha and ask for a meaning of what's happened. It's a very common way of setting up a sutta. And of course, the idea here that the Buddha is the only one who can explain this obviously means we can only explain it from a Buddhist point of view, right? So you get the full, deep understanding in the Buddhist sense, obviously, that's what this refers to. So the only one in the world, and the world meaning anyone, right? Including the gods and whatever, is what is meant here. Okay, so then what happens next Kumara Kassapa actually goes to the Buddha. So then, when the night was over, the venerable Kumara Kassapa went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One what had occurred. Then he asked, "Venerable Sir, what is the anthill? What is the fuming by night and the flaming by day? Who is the Brahmin? Who the wise one? What is the knife? What the delving? What the bar? What the toad? What the fork? What the sea? What the tortoise? What the axe and block? What the piece of meat? And what the Naga serpent?" And then now we come to the explanation of all of these things as the Buddha explains them. Bhikkhu, the anthill or the termite mound is a symbol for this body, made of material form, consisting of the four great elements, procreated by a mother and father, built up out of boiled rice and porridge, and subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away to dissolution and disintegration. So the anthill here, or the termite mound, is a symbol for the physical body. And I think it's the only place in the suttas where this metaphor is used in this way, that the body, anthill is a metaphor for the body. I've never seen it anywhere else. So that's why I mean that the sutta is a little bit out of the ordinary. Perhaps the reason is that in the termite mound or an anthill, there's all this activity going on, right? There's all this kind of ants crawling around in little pathways, or termites crawling around in pathways. It's a bit like the body. The body is always kind of busy as well. There's blood and things circulating in the body, and all kind of activity going in the body, digestion going on, and all kind of stuff happening here. And so the body is always like a heave of activity, just like a termite mound. And one of the reasons probably why we want to put the body behind us in meditation, because it has all this activity, which always is kind of disturbing, I suppose. Another thing with an anthill and a termite mound, if you see a kind of slow exposure film of an anthill, you can see it's changing shape all the time because things are being added, right? The ants are bringing in new material. Or in a termite mound, they're always building on kind of new modules or whatever it is, and adding things. So it's always changing shape. Just like the body is always changing shape, right? You get a bit fatter, you get a bit slimmer, you get older, and things kind of start to wear away and all this kind of stuff. So if we saw a kind of slow exposure film of our body, we see it kind of changing shape all the time, just like an anthill perhaps. So maybe this is the reason why this, I don't know, maybe this is the reason why this this particular picture is used, this particular metaphor, I'm not sure, but anyway, this is what is used here. You have all these all this explanation here for what the body is, and all these explanations that you have here make it very clear that what is meant is the actual physical body, right? What we're talking about is a physical body. It's not some kind of mental body. There's different types of bodies in Buddhism. One is the physical body. Another one is the mind-made body, the kind of body that you have if you get reborn as a deva, right? You still have a body, but it's a different type of body than you have as a human being here. For example, you hear about people having a near-death experience. The symbol you use in the suttas, when you leave your body like that, is like you're drawing a straw out of its sheath. And when you draw a straw out of its sheath, it's almost like you are drawing something which is the same out of, you know, something which is the same gets drawn out of the kind of the old source where it came from. Or a snake which is abandoning its old skin, right? It still looks like the same snake, But so you draw it out. And this is how you create a mind-made body out of the ordinary body. And this is kind of interesting in Buddhism, that the bodies are not kind of limited to the physical realm of human beings. It's not just you have a body now, and then if you move into a spirit realm, or you move into a deva realm or a god realm, you don't have a body. You still have a body, but it's mind-made. And it may look exactly like this one, but it has a different consistency, so to speak, because it is mind-made, etc. It shouldn't, because the Basa realms are all like the jhana realms, so I don't think so. It's a little bit of a complicated question, because it depends on how you understand these, not the Basra realm, what are they called, the Anagami realms, they're called the Suddhavasa, pure abodes. But if they are understood to be jhana realms, you normally wouldn't have any kind of body here, except for maybe something very refined, because it still is a form of rupa there. It's only really when you come to the immaterial realm that you completely abandon any kind of physical substance whatsoever. Yeah, so that is interesting. It's interesting from a number of points of view, but it is interesting because often when, you know, one of the critiques that you hear people have of the idea of rebirth is that they're saying that, well, the mind leaves the body, and then because the mind is separate from the body, they say, well, how can this idea of the mind, which is completely different from the body, how can the two interact, right? If they're completely separate things, how can there be an interaction between the mind and the body? And it is an old philosophical problem that goes back all the way to the time of Descartes, the French philosopher, because he postulated that, you know, there is, on the one hand, there is a, he was talking about what a human being is. On the one hand, there is the mind, and on the other hand, there is the body. On the one hand, there is the soul or the spirit, or I can't remember what he called it, soul possibly, and on the other hand, there is the body. And then he was criticized for that later on by other philosophers for saying, well, if there are two completely separate substances like that, how can they interact if they have nothing in common with each other, if they really are completely separate? And sometimes you will hear people say the same thing to Buddhists. They will they will argue that this idea of rebirth is impossible because it has the same problem as the Descartesian philosophy of substances that are completely separate. But actually, it isn't really like that in Buddhism, because when the mind kind of is withdrawn from the body, there's still some aspect of body there, right? They're not completely separate from a Buddhist point of view. They're not completely different entities that have nothing in common. There's still some kind of commonality that binds the two together. So you still have a kind of form and body, even with that mind, which then gets withdrawn from the body. So there are other reasons as well why that argument may not work. But that is a good way of looking at the Buddhist idea of rebirth, which kind of doesn't fall into that problem, which sometimes is postulated by other people. So, yeah, and this is procreated, sambhava, it's originated through mother and father, right? So again, we're talking about the physical body here. It's interesting here that it doesn't say, right, that the body is created or originated by kamma. It says it is created by mother and father. So what does that mean? How do we reconcile the idea of kamma with this idea of it being originated through mother and father? How are these things to be understood? How do they work together? And the point here, I think, is that kamma is what decides roughly where you get reborn, whether you get reborn in the human realm or as an animal perhaps, or perhaps as a deva, right? That's what kamma does. And then kamma may also help you to decide which family you get reborn in. Do you get reborn in, you know, a wealthy family or a poor family? And it may also decide whether you get reborn into a specific family because you have certain connections there, certain attachments to people from a past life, etc. So that's what kamma does. It gives you a general guideline for where you get reborn, but not always maybe a specific person that karma decides where you get reborn. And even if it does decide a specific person, it doesn't decide the specific, perhaps, body that you get when you get reborn. That specific body is decided by your parents, right? Because then the idea of the genetic material, etc., is what decides specifically what you look like and some of the other aspects of you, like your abilities or whatever. So there are both of these aspects working together. There's karma on the one hand, which is the rough idea where the mind establishes itself in a future existence. That's decided by karma. But then the other aspect is actually about mother and father, about genetic material and inheritance from the past in that sense. Does that make sense what I'm saying? So that these two kind of come together in this way. So there is you can see how the physical kind of inheritance and the karma work together in this way to create a new being in the future. And this is also why there isn't any contradiction in Buddhism between the idea of evolution on the one hand and reincarnation on the other. Often people say, well, how can you have evolution when you have reincarnation? Because according to reincarnation, everything is decided by karma, where you go in the future. But karma is what decides your mental evolution, roughly where you go in the future life, roughly where your consciousness is stationed. Whereas the theory of evolution is just a theory which concerns physical body, how physical characteristics are handed down from one generation to the next one. What mind inhabits that particular physical body is not up to evolution to decide. That's what karma decides, what mind inhabits the body. But the shape of the body is decided through evolution. So it's like two things that cross each other, and then they work together to create any kind of being. The evolution on the one hand, and then you have the kind of mental karma which works together with that. And then you, yeah. Anyway, I find these things a bit fascinating because you have to make sense of how the Buddhist teachings fits into modern scientific notions of, you know, how the world works. If you can't really explain these things, it's a bit kind of troubling because truth is truth wherever you find it, and you have to somehow make these things work together. Yeah. So that's why I find these things interesting and fascinating. Yeah, yes, Joma. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. There is. I think that's true as well. So that's an important point. And I think the point there is that the inherited material you have from your parents is not the only thing which decides what qualities you have, because the genes can turn out in many, many different, the same genetic material can, depending on what genes get turned on or what get turned off, there's all these complicated factors to decide what genes eventually kind of decide your, you know, your characteristics as a person. So that could be another influence of karma, is deciding exactly how that genetic material is used. So it is quite complicated, you're right, and it's not just a factor of inheritance as such. Yeah. Okay. So that is the anthill, which is the termite mound, a symbol for the physical body here. And all of these other things are just basically, I think, they're just there to say that it is a physical body. It's built up out of boiled rice and porridge, right? I like that one. It's quite very clear. And subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away, to dissolution and disintegration, the impermanence of the body. And this is an example. The impermanence of the body is an interesting example of something which changes quite slowly, right? The body in another sutta is said to be something which it arises basically when you get born, and then when it passes away and it disappears when you die. And in the meantime, it is there, but it's changing while it's there. We often think of things as changing with every mind moment, arising, staying, and passing away, right? Something which is kind of changing all the time. But with the physical body, it's actually something which remains for quite a long time before it passes away. I think it's a sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya which talks about the physical body arising and then lasting for 60, 80 or 100 years and then passing away at the end of that. So it's not all, not everything in Buddhism is this idea, this Abhidhamma idea which comes later on about things only lasting one mind moment and then disappearing. That is not how the suttas look at impermanence. The suttas have a much, have a different view of that. I think that is good to recognize, and it shows you that there is a difference there between the Abhidhamma way of looking at things and the Sutta way of looking at things. That is important because a lot of Buddhist philosophy etc. is built up around these Abhidhamma ideas and not around how things are explained in the suttas. And for that reason, sometimes it's good to kind of go back to the suttas to see how the Buddha talked about this. And that gives you, I think, a better idea of how to understand things like impermanence, especially in relation to the body. With the mind, of course, it's much faster, but even there, things might last for a while. It may not be moment to moment. Like a deep state of samadhi might last for hours, right? Again, it's not a moment-to-moment thing. It's something which lasts, arises, and lasts for a long time, then passes away. A feeling of happiness or whatever, it can last for a while and then pass away. So I would say that the idea of momentariness is a later development, whereas in the suttas, they have more this idea of things lasting for a while, and while they last, they are changing. You feel a state of happiness, perhaps, but it's changing a little bit as you're feeling it, right? It's not entirely constant. The body lasts for almost 100 years, or if you're lucky, but it's changing all the while it's there. So this has implications, right? It has implications for how we meditate, how we understand insight. What do we mean by insight? Insight is not just about seeing this arising and passing away all the time. It's about understanding simply that the body comes into being and then eventually passes away. It's a broader understanding, not just a direct experience of things passing away and arising. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, I suppose. Okay. So, yes. Yeah. Right. It is constantly changing. It's constantly changing. It's true. But there is also like an element of continuity there, right? You look yourself in the mirror from one day to the next. You can say, "Well, it's still the same person." You know, I can recognize you, Pauline, even though you're changed a little bit. I recognize you. What was that? Exactly. I'm not sure if at the time of the Buddha, they obviously wouldn't have known about the idea that the cells are being regenerated all the time. They would just look at the body and say, okay, yeah, you get born and you die, so you stay that time between her. Yeah. Okay. That is the first one. So this anthill is the symbol for the physical body here. And then it says that what one thinks and ponders by night, based upon one's actions during the day, is the fuming by night, right? I'm sure you can recognize that. You recognize that, you know, the things that you dream about at night, or you think about in the evening or whatever, you think about all the things that happened during the day, right? All the things you have done, and they kind of come back to you. You have a conversation with somebody, and then there's an echo in the mind afterwards. You think about that conversation, you know, and sometimes you worry about whether you said the right thing or not. And then it kind of carries on over later on. Because of all that thinking at night, it says here, the actions one undertakes during the day by body, speech, and mind, after thinking and pondering by night, is a flaming by day. So these things are kind of mutually support each other. You think at night, and then in the morning you act in dependence on those things later on, to some extent anyway. How do we overcome this fuming by night then? Because of course it is not so nice if you fume too much by night. It means you don't have a very good night's sleep, right? you kind of toss and turn and all these things happen in your mind. So how do we overcome that? How do we have a good night's sleep? And this is actually also explained in the suttas. They're very practical, tell you how to have a good night's sleep. And of course they say that the way to have a good night's sleep is to develop metta, right? Loving kindness. When you have loving kindness, then you sleep really, really well. One of the famous benefits of loving kindness meditation, you sleep well, and when you wake up in the morning, you feel energetic and ready for the day. That's what it says. You can see why, because when you have a sense of metta, there's nothing really to think about, right? You feel confident about your actions, you feel confident that you did the right thing, you feel confident, you don't have anything to worry about so much, so you can let go of things so easily when you have a sense of metta. If you haven't got that metta, you are more uncertain about your actions, because the defilements of your mind, they make you, you become more uncertain of whether you really acted out of purity or not. So if you have metta, you feel certain, there's nothing really to worry about. And for that reason, it's easy to let go. And then when you fall asleep easily. There's no, very little reverberation, so to speak, from the things that you did during the day. Okay. So this is the body that fumes by night and flames by day. And then the Buddha says, the Brahmin is a symbol for the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, right? If you think back to the verse, it says, each verse says, thus spoke the Brahmin. The Brahmin says, throw out the piece of meat, right? So the Brahmin is giving advice. So the Brahmin is acting as a teacher in those verses. So of course the teacher is the Tathagata, it's the Buddha. So the Buddha is here the one who teaches. That sort of makes sense. And the wise one is a symbol for a bhikkhu or anyone else in higher training. In other words, the arya, the person who has reached at least one stage of awakening, right? The stream enter or above, that's a symbol of the person here. So the wise one is the person the Buddha is speaking to. So the Brahmin says, listen, wise one, do this, throw out the piece of meat. So he's teaching here the arya. Of course, these teachings are true to everyone, not only for the Aryas. There's some aspect to these things that need to be done by all of us. In fact, you will see later on that it's not just for the Arya, this one. This is also a slightly broader teaching because it includes things like doubt. Now, doubt has already been overcome by the Arya, so it is already slightly broader than the Aryas. But the Aryan is, of course, the person who is fully able to take on board these teachings and practice them 100%. And that's why I think the Arya is mentioned here, because they have this ability to actually comply with these instructions. The knife is a symbol for noble wisdom. So noble wisdom, again, it shows that we are dealing with the Aryas, the noble people. That's why it's noble wisdom. So this is a bit like yoniso manasikara, right? The wise attention, the noble wisdom, the place and the attending in the right place, the ability to practice properly. So you have this sharpness with you. The knife is something very sharp. It's able to cut. It's able to cut through the nonsense. And of course, that sharpness of the knife comes from once deep meditation practice. It's only when you have very deep meditation that your mind becomes sufficiently sharp to cut through things. So it's samadhi, it is the jhanas that enable the mind to have this sharp wisdom. It's only then that it really becomes a knife. A knife is almost like a metaphor for samadhi here, because that is what is required to be able to see these things so clearly. And that the delving is a symbol for the arousing of energy. You delve with a knife, abhikana, which means like to, almost like to dig. You dig with a knife, digging into the termite mound, right? Trying to figure out what's going on in this bodily termite mound of ours. And that is the arousing of energy. You arouse energy to accomplish this. Okay, so that is the... those are the general symbols that occur in every verse, and now we come to the actual symbols that occur in each specific verse. And the first one, the bar, is a symbol for ignorance. Throw out the bar, abandon ignorance, delve with a knife, thou wise one. This is the meaning here. So in the verse, the Buddha says, delve into the termite mound, and when you delve into it, what you find is a bar, right? And when you find the bar, you should throw it out. This means that you should chuck out ignorance, basically. And of course, the idea of a bar being symbol for ignorance is fairly obvious, right? A bar means you cannot move on. You are blocked, right? Something which stops you and hinders you from going somewhere. It bars you, quite literally. So because you are barred, you are stuck. And this is one of the symbols throughout the suttas of ignorance, or avidya is the word in Pali. Avidya being the opposite of vidya, which means understanding or seeing things clearly. And because you don't see things clearly, because you're not able to understand what the world is like, because you have wrong view, because everything is unclear or whatever, you are barred from making progress. There's a darkness inside of you, a darkness which doesn't see, and so it stops you from moving on. So ignorance is the biggest hindrance that we can have. We're all blocked and barred by ignorance from moving on. And it's quite scary, because sometimes you can feel that ignorance in yourself, you can feel that you can't really see, but you also don't know the way out, right? Because the very fact that you have ignorance means that you don't know the way out, because these things go together. Understanding the way out is already having a sense of wisdom. So it's very hard. That's why ignorance is such a massive obstacle, because you don't even know how to get rid of it. So throwing out ignorance basically means just that gradually you're moving on, kind of seeing the mind is kind of brightening up as you practice, right? You throw out the hindrances, you throw out things, and slowly you're able to elevate yourself out of that ignorance. And you may have seen that in your own life as you practice. It's like you are lifting yourself up, you get a higher perspective, and one day you understand that before I was ignorant, I didn't really understand my defilements. I didn't understand what was going on. Now I can see, right? Suddenly you can see something more. And this ignorance, then you kind of lifting yourself out, you're allowing your mind to soar up, so to speak, getting a bird's eye view of things, understanding things much better. And one of the crucial points at which ignorance is abandoned to a large extent is when you get samadhi for the first time. And samadhi is always explained in the suttas as this climbing a mountain and then seeing the landscape around you. Suddenly you have a bird's eye view. You see what's going on in samadhi. Before that, you have been trapped in the jungle of the senses. All you have are the five senses, right? The objects of the five senses. This is the thing that we are trapped in almost all the time. We're trapped. All we do is see, hear, from the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you go to bed at night, and even while you dream, you're seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and touching things, right? You're trapped. This is all we know. And then one day, you're able, through developing the mind, to go get above that, and you can look down on the jungle of sense desire, on the jungle of sensory objects, on the jungle of the sensory world. And suddenly you understand, now I understand. Now I understand why all that was suffering, why it was a problem, why I was trapped by these things, while I was shackled and tied and fettered by all these sensual objects and the sensual desires in me. And this is like the first time that you start to kind of move out of ignorance and you start to see things more clearly. It is actually, it's a gradual moving out, but at that point it becomes very clear. And this is the problem, that the delusion, the ignorance, is very, very strong and very powerful. And it takes a long time. But one of the things the Buddha says in the suttas, which is quite nice, and that is where he says that there's two different types of ignorance, in a sense. And one is the person who is ignorant but doesn't understand that they're ignorant. And of course, if you are ignorant and you have no clue that you're ignorant, even if you might even think you're wise, while you're actually completely, you haven't got a clue what's going on. This is quite common, right? I think we all probably have that to some extent. We think we're wise, but actually, we don't really know what's happening here. But then there's a person who is ignorant and has some kind of grasp that they actually are ignorant. They have some kind of understanding. And the Buddha says very nicely that the person who understands that they're ignorant, well, at least they're wise to that extent, right? Because you understand that it was a problem. So that means that you can do something about it. But if you don't even understand there's a problem, well, basically you're trapped. And this is the part of the... This, of course, then it becomes a really massive problem. And then there is the problem of what do we mean here by ignorance? I've already given you some idea that it means, for example, getting the perspective you have in samadhi. But there is also a more specific meaning of ignorance in the suttas. And this is If you understand the word behind ignorance here is avidya in Pali. Now, avidya means literally non-vidya. And vidya means to understand things. It means to see the world as it actually is. And in the suttas, there is the te vidya, the three knowledges. And the three knowledges are always remembering your past lives, seeing how karma operates from life to life. And the last one is penetrating to full awakening, right? These are the three vidyas in the suttas. And avidya here must then be the opposite of that, right? A is a negative, meaning like un or non, non-knowledge, non-understanding. Yeah? So avidya is, can mean many things, but it specifically means that non-seeing of past lives, non-seeing of the laws of karma, and the non-awakening experience. That's specifically what it means. So ignorance may not be a very good translation, because it actually means a lack of understanding of the world as it actually is. That's really what it means. It's fascinating, isn't it, that this is what it meant by ignorance. This is what it means by kind of having a lack of insight or understanding. Are these things, right? Often we think of Buddhism as sitting down and watching things kind of rising and passing away or whatever, and we get insight that way. But actually the real insight, the one that really matters, are these three knowledges I've been talking about. So we throw out the ignorance. Ignorance is actually the most profound of the problems on the spiritual path. So usually it's the last thing you throw out. When you fully throw out ignorance, that's when you reach the full awakening here. So that is one of the little bit of the strange things in this sutta. It's not really ordered very nicely here. It has ignorance first, but usually ignorance would be the last thing here. And there are some Chinese parallels to this sutta as well. This sutta exists in many different versions. And in the other versions, the sequence is different, right? It doesn't have the same sequence. But none of the sequences make all that much sense from a systematic point of view. So it's a bit strange. I would have felt it more natural if you had the ignorance coming towards the end. But anyway, that's the way things sometimes are here. Okay. So there you are. That's the first one. Throw out the bar. Everybody happy with the bar and ignorance? Yeah? Yes? Yes, to some extent, that's true. I mean, we're talking about English words now, right? So you have to kind of go back to the Pali to really make sense. If in English it might be, but in Pali it might not be. So it depends on which words you use. But in English, I would say ignorance and delusion are basically, to a large extent, interchangeable. But in Pali, it is a slight difference. The word usually translated with delusion in Pali is moha. And moha has this idea of being confused, but moha is not as profound as avidya. Avidya is more deep and it goes more to the core of things, whereas moha is slightly more superficial. It is possible, for example, the suttas talk about moha is one of the three roots of bad karma. So you have lobha, dosa, moha, right? The three roots of bad karma. Now, it cannot mean delusion in the most profound sense. Because if it did, it would be possible to make good karma, right? Because it's possible to take away the moha and make good karma. So good karma means there is no moha, there's no lobha, there's no dosa. So in that sense, moha, delusion, yes, but it means more, in that case, it means more like confusion, more like an ordinary state of mind that you have, which is confused, which is dull, perhaps, which is restless, which just doesn't understand what's going on, right? So that's the usual meaning of moha in the suttas, the normal meaning. It can, but sometimes these words are also a bit flexible. They might mean different things in different contexts. They complicate things again, right? So it's not, yeah. But anyway, but avidya is the most profound, the deepest sense in which this is used. Okay. Okay, then we come to the next one. This is the toad. The toad is a symbol for despair due to anger. Throw out the toad, abandon despair due to anger. Deal with the knife. Though wise one, this is the meaning here. Despair due to anger is kod upayasa, And upayasa is one of the ways that dukkha or suffering is described in the suttas, and koda is just anger. So exactly how this should be translated is a bit not entirely clear. It could be, mean anger and I'm not sure if despair is, might be too strong a word. Anger and being troubled is another possible translation. Or it could be troubledness due to anger, for example, or something like that. But the main point here is that anger is kind of the main term here, the one that really matters. So anger is the one that is important. And again, this is the one that I would have thought should have been first in this list, and ignorance coming last. Because anger is one of the most basic things, one of the most basic of the mental defilements that we have to overcome. It is the one which creates the most problems for us in relationship to other people. It's the one which is very painful. It's the one which creates lots of bad karma. It's the one which deludes the mind in a very powerful way, and therefore takes you away from the spiritual path and nibbana and all these kind of things. So anger is actually a very kind of basic thing that we need to deal with on the spiritual path. Often we talk about the three types of bad thought, right, or intention, being anger, desire, or sense desire, and the last one is vihinsa, which means like, often translated as cruelty, but cruelty is not a very good translation. More like harming, or maybe ruthlessness is a translation I like. You are ruthless. You are, in other words, you have a cold heart towards the suffering of others, right? You don't care if other beings suffer. You just do your thing. If that causes suffering for others, well, that's tough luck for those other beings. That's kind of what vihinsa means. It's ruthless strike in your personality. But of these things, anger is the most problematic one, is the most basic one. And sense desire is much more difficult to deal with, and much more profound and much deeper. So anger is more basic and much more important to deal with that. So that's why I think that is singled out in this way, because it needs to be worked on quite quickly. Okay, so it's interesting, the symbol here is a toad, right? Toad is usually considered an ugly animal. Toad, you know, particularly in kind of European mythology, with the princess and the toad and that kind of those kind of stories. You're supposed to kiss the frog or kiss the toad, and then the toad turns into a prince. But it's kind of repulsive to kiss a frog or a toad, right? So you have to overcome that repulsion to be able to get the prince. So the toad is something ugly, and this, of course, ties in with the idea of anger, right? Anger makes you an ugly person. Often it makes your features ugly, but it also makes you repulsive to other people. People don't like angry people. It makes you kind of, ooh, I want to stay away from that person. It's just unpleasant to be around someone who is angry. So the toad metaphor there, I think, is quite apt. It makes good sense. And the bar metaphor for ignorance, also very apt and makes good sense. Next one is the fork. The fork is a symbol for doubt. Throw out the fork, abandon doubt. Delve with a knife, the wise one. This is the meaning here. And of course, the fork, this is here a fork with two prongs, right? Two kind of, what are they called? Tines, what are they called? The two things. Is it the forked path with two possible alternatives, one way or the other way, and then you don't know. That's why the fork is always a symbol for doubt, because there's this uncertainty, two possibilities, and you don't know which one. And doubt in Buddhism is quite good to understand what we mean by doubt, because doubt is a very broad word, and it's important to kind of pin it down a little bit to understand what we're talking about when we talk about doubt. And doubt here, the word for Pali word is vichikicca. Vichikicca is the same word as in the five hindrances. We talk about doubt in the five hindrances. And the way that vichikicca is described in the suttas, the way it is defined, it is doubt about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. Right? So when you look inside of yourself, you don't really know whether this mind state you have now, is it wholesome or unwholesome? Are there defilements there or not? And you are uncertain. Sometimes you know, sometimes it's very obvious that your mind is defiled, right? You have a strong desire, you have a strong anger, whatever. Okay, there's no doubt at all. But sometimes you feel kind of not really sure. You feel reasonably balanced, reasonably well, but is there perhaps still some hindrance left in the mind? Is there still some defilement there? And chances are there is, right? Unless you can sit down and go straight into a very deep state of samadhi, of meditation, there is bound to be some kind of hindrance there. But you don't even know exactly what to do because it doesn't feel like there's a hindrance. And this is the problem with doubt. You cannot see clearly what is going on. And this is very much part and parcel of the path of meditation, is to uncover the depth of the defilements, to understand yourself, understand your mind so fully that you can see every aspect of the mind, all the aspects of the defilements, how deep they actually go and all these things. This is part of what it means to go through the process of meditation and investigating yourself and understanding yourself. And this is why overcoming doubt is so crucial. As long as you have doubt, it means you're not able to overcome the defilements. You can only overcome that which you understand. You have to see the defilement first. Only then can you overcome it. If you don't even know what it is, there's no way that you can overcome it, right? So doubt is a problem because it stops you from being able to overcome and move onwards on the Buddhist path. I don't sure if it's that kind of doubt, because the doubt you mean is like the doubt, oh, is it this way, is it that way kind of thing, yeah. But this is more like, almost like a delusion in a sense. You just don't understand what is going on. You don't understand, you know, you don't know what is good and what is bad, basically, here. Even if you don't think, is it this or that way, you still have doubt, because it means that you don't understand what's happening here. So, I don't think you can overcome that by going deeper, because you have to overcome the defilements before you can go deeper. If you don't know what the defilements are, and you haven't overcome them, you can't just keep, you know, plugging away on the meditation object unless the defilements have been removed first. You can do that, but nothing's going to happen. It's like a barrier in the road which is blocking you from moving forward. That's what they call hindrances, right? You're kind of banging your head against a brick wall and not getting through because your head isn't strong enough to break through the bricks. The hindrances are that powerful. So I think there can be some help to being one-pointed, because what one-pointedness does when you focus on an object is that you're taking away the attention from the things that increase the defilements, because the defilements are basically they arise because of conditions, right? And the conditions for the rising of defilements is a sensual desire is seeing the beautiful in something. Yeah? So you get desire because you see something you like. Yeah? Anger, it is very well known, the problem with anger is that you see the repulsive or something you don't like in something, you get angry. Yeah? Of course, if you stay with one object, then you are not attending to those things, so that defilements can die down. But again, it's only to a certain extent, and then there will be a residue which is left, and you can't abandon that. That has to be abandoned through being wise, basically, to understand that this doesn't work. This, you know, this pleasure is not going to actually give me any real happiness. It has to be abandoned in a more profound sense through a degree of wisdom. Yeah. Okay, so that is doubt, specifically the doubt about what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, and to specifically understand your own mind, what in me is wholesome, what is unwholesome, so that you can work with that and you can overcome these things. And they are usually, in the end, they always overcome through wisdom. Wisdom is what overcomes defilements. There's a very interesting sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya which says there are two kinds of powers. A very short sutta, and that one power is called the Patisankhana Bala. Bala is power. Patisankhana means to reflect or to contemplate. Because the power of contemplation, is that what that means? And the other power is the Bhavana Bala. And Bhavana means, Bhavana means to develop. So it's the power of development. And the power of development is then explained as the four jhanas or the seven factors of awakening. So in other words, it's explained in terms of samadhi. If you want to develop the mind, the power of development is the development in samadhi. Whereas the Patisankhana Bala is explained as overcoming the unwholesome conduct, right? Body, speech and mind. Specifically, so the way that you overcome unwholesome states is through reflection, through reflecting wisely, through understanding that these things are suffering, they are a problem. To touch these things is painful. And by so it's actually reflection and wisdom that takes you away from these defilements and move you in the right direction. It's a very important idea, because very often we think that we use willpower to overcome problems in life, right? We use willpower to hold back the anger. We use willpower not to have too much desire for the things we're not supposed to have desire for, etc. But actually, no. Sometimes maybe a little bit of willpower is in its place, but 90% of the time it is wisdom, understanding things rightly, which is the source for overcoming the defilements. It's the patisankana bala, the power of reflection, which makes these things go away here. Okay, so that's the fork being a symbol for doubt. Again, a very apt kind of symbol, isn't there? It makes good sense. Everybody happy with that? Makes sense? Okay, then we come to the next one. And it says here, the sieve is a symbol for the five hindrances, namely the hindrance of sensual desire, the hindrance of ill will, the hindrance of sloth and torpor, or if you like, just tiredness and dullness, the hindrance of restlessness and remorse, and the hindrance of doubt. Throw out the sieve, abandon the five hindrances, delve with a knife, though wise one. This is the meaning here. And this is where I fail to see the connection between the five hindrances and the sieve. I really don't know exactly how that works. This is the only place in the suttas where this symbol is used, this metaphor is used. Other translations for that Pali term behind us, it was a very rare Pali term. I don't think I've seen it apart from here. It can perhaps mean a bowl or something like that, a bowl or a sieve. But regardless, I don't really understand why or what that has to do with the five hindrances. I can't get my head around that. There might very well be a reason, but exactly what it is, I'm not sure. Yes. Is it what? A cover. Ah, okay. Yeah. Ah, okay. Right. Five covers, yeah. Okay, so this could be like a cover, you think, something which covers something up. Five covers, yeah. Okay, yeah, maybe that is a connection there. Yeah, five cover, yeah. You have to uncover it in a sense, or you have to kind of, yeah, yeah, you're really right. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay.
So doubt is mentioned twice here, the fork and then the hand with the hindrances. So it's the fork, the bed of doubt, opposed to the hindrance.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it is the same thing here probably. I think there's I think the whole thing with the five hindrances is a bit strange. I don't know why the five hindrances are mentioned here, because you already have anger, you already have doubt, and later on you have sensual pleasure just below. So five hindrances, maybe they could come a bit further down at the very least, but it's not entirely clear why they are there. In fact, in the Chinese version of the sutta, the hindrances don't actually occur. So yeah, it's uncertain. But I think it's probably the same thing, because we are trying to get rid of anyway, the two are very closely related to each other. You know, the fetter. The fetter is a bit more profound and deep, but they are very closely related to each other. How does the doubt as a fetter go again? That has more to do with doubt about the Dhamma, right? Because once you remove the fetter and you have an understanding of the Buddha's teachings, you have no doubt about the Dhamma anymore. It includes the doubt in understanding the good and bad mental states. It includes that, but it's broader than that. It has to do with the whole teaching of the Buddha, dependent arising, all these kind of things. Yes, sir. Yeah, yeah. Possibly, yeah. It's like the mind is just leaking. Instead of you kind of being contained inside of yourself and just being complete within yourself, you leak out into the world, perhaps, something like that. Yeah. These are possibilities, but these are all, yeah. Okay, anyway, so these are the five hindrances. And Again, just very briefly, remember that there is a sequence here, right? The most important of these hindrances, the most difficult one, is sensual desire. This is the overarching one, and that is the one which ultimately is the one, when you give that up, the rest of it tends to fall apart, and then the samadhi becomes available. But in practical respects, the most important one is probably the second one, ill will, because that's the one we can deal with usually straight away. Just 1 second, because I'll get back to you. And then the hindrances of sloth or tiredness, etc., and restlessness and remorse, these are more like secondary hindrances, and they are very largely dependent on the first two. So it is the first two that we mostly need to deal with. That's actually quite an important insight, right? Often people say, how do we deal with tiredness and restlessness in meditation practice? But very often there isn't that much you can do about it, because the root cause is actually desire or some kind of ill will which lies behind that. That is really the root cause. What we need to deal with is go back to the root, and then these lesser hindrances will tend to be overcome as a consequence. And doubt, the last one, has to be overcome by investigation, investigating your mind, finding out for yourself what is wholesome, what isn't, by coming to understand these things. Nicholas. I see there's a screen. Okay. Okay. So it's like you see, it's like distorted because you can't see clearly. Can't see clearly. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But again, it's only, I think it only occurs in this one place in the sutta, so it is a little bit obscure. Okay. I'm not going to say anything more about the five hindrances. Everybody happy with the five hindrances? Yeah. Okay, so then comes the next one, and this one, next one, is the five aggregates, and there's the tortoise is the symbol for this, and this only occurs in the Pali. It does not occur in the Chinese versions of the sutta, and again, all of these other things that we're talking about are really mental defilements or mental problems that we have to overcome. So all of the other ones kind of fit fairly nicely together as a whole. Whereas the five aggregates are a little bit outside of that scheme. And the difference is that with the five aggregates, yes, you have to throw them out in a certain way, but the mental defilements have literally to be abandoned. You actually have to abandon them quite literally, and they disappear entirely. But the way you abandon the five aggregates is a different way. You don't actually get rid of the five aggregates. You still have a body, you still have a mind after you become an awakened or an arahant. But the way you abandon those is precisely by abandoning the defilements of the mind. When you abandon the defilements, you abandon the aggregates, because you no longer have a sense of ownership or attachment or desire for them. And that is how they actually are overcome. So it's actually the abandoning of the defilements, the abandoning of the other stuff in this list, which causes the giving up of the aggregates as well. So it's a slightly different way of abandoning, if you understand what I'm trying to say here. Anyway, let's see what the Buddha says here. The tortoise is a symbol for the five aggregates affected by clinging, namely the material form aggregate affected by clinging, the feeling aggregate affected by clinging, the perception aggregate affected by clinging, the formations aggregate affected by clinging, and the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. Throw out the tortoise, abandon the five aggregates affected by clinging. Delve with a knife, though wise one. This is the meaning. So the tortoise here, the reason the tortoise is a symbol for the five aggregates is that the tortoise, when it stretches, you know, the tortoise is inside the shell and it stretches out its limbs, right? And when it stretches out the limbs, you have two front legs, two back legs, and then you have the head in the front. So there's five limbs that the tortoise has. So this seems to be the reason why this is a symbol for the five aggregates. The five aggregates, just very briefly, the importance of these things in the Buddhist teachings is not, this is not really so much a doctrine or, you know, something that you just kind of take. This is a very, remember that the teachings of the Buddha are very practical teachings, right? They have a very specific purpose to move you towards awakening. So there is a reason why the Buddha teaches the five aggregates in this way. It is not just a kind of a philosophical idea of how, you know, we are made up as humans, anything like that. It's very practical, pragmatic. And the reason why he teaches these five things is because this is where we tend to hold on to. This is what we tend to cling to as being me and mine, right? This is where we have attachments in these particular areas. So if you want to overcome those attachments, if you want to overcome the, the holding on to this, what you take to be yourself, this is what you have to investigate. And that's why the Buddha teaches this. It's not just some kind of philosophical framework. It's very important to remember that. All the teachings of the Buddha are very pragmatic. They're very practical. They have a purpose. It's not just some kind of mental construct without practical reasons. So whether the five aggregates, whether they are an explanation of everything it is to be human, whether there's anything apart from the five aggregates and all that stuff, it's really irrelevant. You know, sometimes people ask this question, oh, this is how the human being or the animal or whatever is described in Buddhism. This is how we're made up of, and there's nothing apart from that. Well, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. It doesn't really matter. It's irrelevant because it is the pragmatic purpose here is simply to focus on those things that are cause a problem. Those things where you have an attachment, those things where you have a desire. That is the purpose of this. It's not a purpose to create a scheme or set up some philosophical structure that explains reality in all its details. That's not the point here. So remember this, the practical side of these things. I'll get back to you, Peter. I'll just finish this one first. So how then can we understand these aggregates in a practical way? I'm sure all of you already know about the five aggregates. They're kind of one of the most common teachings you will hear about as a Buddhist. But one of the ways to understand these things in a pragmatic and practical way is to understand them through your own meditation experience. What happens when you meditate? And this is, remember, we're talking about the five aggregates. By talking about them, understanding them means to understand them in terms of the three characteristics, right? Impermanence, suffering, and non-self. That's how we try to understand all of these aggregates. So when you meditate, what happens to your physical body? You start to become peaceful. And when you become peaceful, you start to see that your physical body starts to, it's almost like it fades away a little bit, right? If you feel tense or you feel very restless or whatever, or agitated, your physical body is very prominent because it's causing you a certain amount of suffering and problems, right? Tension is a state of suffering. You feel tense. But the body, which is really relaxed, which doesn't cause you any suffering, any problem, it's like it fades away. It's not important anymore. It doesn't actually impact on you because there's no business to be done in that body. In the same way, if you get a lot of pleasure through the body, then of course the body is important again because it provides pleasure for you. But once you take away the pleasure side and you take away the suffering side, the body becomes irrelevant, right? Who cares about the body? It doesn't give you any trouble, doesn't give you any happiness. That's why it starts to fade away in meditation. So this is what we mean by the body being impermanent, right? The body starts to fade away, disappear. It doesn't impact on your consciousness anymore. It doesn't leave an imprint on your mind. It starts to disappear as you meditate. And then as the deeper you go in meditation, the less of the body there is. Sometimes all you have left is the breath, right? The last part of the meditation being the breath. And then even that disappears. And eventually the body is completely gone. So this is how you start to understand this aggregate of the body. It's through direct experience. It's not some kind of, again, philosophy or something you need to think too much about. But the best way is to understand it through the experience you have in your meditation practice. And then, of course, what you realize is that when the body is gone, it's happy, right? Wow, the body is gone. What happiness it is not to have a body anymore. And this, of course, means that you start to understand the suffering of the body. There's a problem there, right? It's when it's gone, it's much better. So you start to understand the suffering. You understand impermanence, then you understand suffering. And, of course, the very fact that it is gone, that you can leave these things behind, that is something you don't have to own, it doesn't have to always be there, also means it's non-self. The body is not something which you have to hold on to. It's something which disappears and it's gone, okay? So it can't be a self. A self is something which always has to be there. So this is how you understand these aggregates. And then the feeling aggregate is a similar kind of thing here. As your meditation deepens, certain feelings start to disappear, right? And other feelings start to arise. The feelings that start to disappear are the feelings of pain in life. The deeper your meditation is, the less painful feelings you have, the less dukkha feelings you have. The dukkha in the body fades away, right? Some of the pain in the mind, as you let go of the past and the future, some of the pain in the mind starts to pass away. And the further you go, and then you have happiness and joy arising instead. So certain feelings are anicca, impermanent, they disappear, while other feelings arise, right? So feelings are changing, they are impermanent. And then as you move through the meditation process, more and more of the coarse feelings disappear, more and more refined feelings appear in your meditation practice. There's a gradual moving through feeling, feelings changing, anicca, the dukkha of certain feelings. You start to see the dukkha of certain feelings, while other feelings are starting to appear as happiness. And only later on will you understand that even those feelings too are dukkha. And then you start to see also the non-self of these feelings, right? You understand that they are impermanent, disappearing. You don't need this suffering. The suffering isn't who you are. Suffering can be left behind, according to the Buddha's teachings. So again, you can see the aggregate of feeling, experience it directly through your meditation practice, and see how things change. This is how we deal with these five aggregates. It's important to make it pragmatic and practical, otherwise it loses its meaning. Perception, again, a very similar kind of thing. Perception is a very, very broad aggregate. I don't like the word aggregate. It's like a group, right? It's a group. All perceptions form a group. That's what it basically means. It's a group. All feelings form a group. All bodily phenomena form a group. That's what it means. So the group of perception. And perception is basically how we see the world, how we understand the world. So you see things. So when you see something, it's perception, right? When I see out now, I see this room, I see all of you, I see my, you know, we see all this stuff. This is perception, and then you're able to make sense of it, right? You see whether someone is your friend or your enemy or whatever. That's also perception. You hear things. That's perception. Your ability to distinguish what you're hearing, to understand the meaning of things, is perception. So everything that comes through the senses is perception, is always part of that. And of course, as you meditate, your perception changes, right? You are shutting out many of the senses. You don't hear anymore. You don't see anymore. You don't feel the body anymore. And you start to feel more happiness and joy and all these other kind of things. So your perception of the world is changing. And as you see that, again, it's a similar kind of process. It's impermanent. You see that certain perceptions are suffering as you go through this. And you see that some of these are non-self because they fade away and disappear. So that is the perception. Same thing with it's called the formations aggregate. Again, formations aggregate. Sankara, it means the will. It means the doer. It means the volition, the intention inside. And you can see the same thing with the intention inside, how intention becomes more and more peaceful as your mind becomes peaceful. You will less and less. You desire less and less. The mind is moving less and less. Until one day it becomes completely still. And all movement of the mind, all sankhara is stilled, right? Sabbe sankhara samatha, the calming of all sankharas. The mind is perfectly still. And then you realize that the will itself is impermanent, right? One day it's gone, it's no longer there. It's impermanent. Not only is it gone, but it's happiness when it's gone. So it's suffering. It's non-self, because when it's gone, you're still there in a sense, but something else is there, but the will is gone. So it must be non-self. And the last one is consciousness. The same thing again. Consciousness is a consciousness of the six senses, and you can start to see the fading away of consciousness by simply seeing that the senses are disappearing one by one. And also consciousness is becoming more and more refined. Again, it's impermanent. You see that when the consciousness disappears, it's happiness, so consciousness must be suffering. And again, it's non-self, because the disappearance is possible. So this is how to deal with these five aggregates in a practical way, in a pragmatic way, to deal with them in a way that actually makes sense. Otherwise, they become theoretical things, right? It's almost like I believe in the five aggregates or whatever. But But that is not the point, right? This becomes like a dogma. It's not a dogma. It's a very pragmatical thing here. Okay. So, did you want to ask anything, Peter? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, but perception is a very broad thing. So you can perceive sankhara, you perceive feelings, you perceive everything. So perception is very broad. Perception can almost include everything else. But the other things are singled out because they are very important subcategories that need to be singled out in their own right. Yeah. Yes. Called Bhanga. Bhavanga. Bhavanga. Sure. This whole process is that similar kind of experience, you know. As you go through the process, I mean, this process I'm just talking about now is also a sense of voiding yourself. It is gradually you're seeing more and more stuff that isn't actually you, and you're becoming more and more void. And that can also be, as you say, you know, as you say there, talking about the fourth tetrad, anapanasati, or is that what you meant? Yeah. You're seeing the impermanence of things, and when you see the impermanence of things again, you get a similar kind of feeling. There's nothing there which really is you. There's nothing to hang on to. So sure, but you know, you will only see that to the full extent after a deep state of samadhi, because then the mind has the strength to actually be able to take that on board fully. Yeah, it could be incredibly sharp. Yeah, exactly. So that's when you can see those to the full extent. But you know, that's good. That's perfectly valid. And that what you're seeing is quite right. It's you're seeing kind of these things. And sometimes it gets a bit scary, right? Does it get scary sometimes?
Well, it's unbelievably scary.
Yeah. But this can be very profound, and the reason why you're scared is because the mind isn't stable enough in that situation. The more profound your samadhi is, the less scared you will be, because you have something very strong to lean on while you do that. Okay. Anyone else? Nobody else. Okay. So that's is it just a brief thing about the five aggregates, just kind of bring them into reality instead of just being these kind of categories that we talk about. Okay. So now we are moving towards the end here. The next one is the axe and block. Is a symbol for the five cords of sensual pleasure, forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desires and provocative of lust. Throw out the axe and block. Abandon the five cords of sensual pleasure. Delve with the knife. the wise one. This is the meaning here. So here again, we're back to the five hindrances. The five hindrances here being the sensual world that you are attached to. And here it has the simile here, or the metaphor, is the axe and block. In other places, this is translated as the slaughterhouse. So I'm not sure exactly which one should be understood. And I'm not entirely sure the exact meaning of this simile here, but it could simply be that, you know, as long as you are attached to the sensuality of the world, you are going to go, this is one of the strongest attachments to samsara, and you're going to continue around in birth and death, all the time, right? Being slaughtered from life to life, being put on the chopping block and then axed as a consequence. And this could be the meaning here. There is a nice simile elsewhere in the sutta, the simile of the cow that is led to the slaughterhouse, right? And the simile is that human beings are just like a cow led to a slaughterhouse. Every step you take in life, every move you make, you're one step closer to death. Just like the cow being led to the slaughterhouse, every step she makes, she's one step closer to death. It's a very powerful simile here. Every movement she makes is one step closer to the slaughterhouse, and is being led towards the slaughterhouse. Our lives are the same. Every time you say something, every word you say, you are one word closer to death, right? So it's a nice way of thinking about things. It kind of makes things clear. So this is what I think is the simile here, what is meant here. Perhaps this is what binds you very strongly. This is the most important of the five hindrances, the thing that binds you more than anything to samsara, and therefore is a very serious problem. So these are all the five senses, right, that are talked about here. It's basically the first of the five hindrances. I don't know if there's anything really more that needs to be said about that for now. Yeah. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Everybody happy? Yeah? Okay. The piece of meat is a symbol for delight and lust. Nandiraga, delight and desire. Throw out the piece of meat, abandon delight and desire. Delve with a knife, thou wise one. This is the meaning here. And the piece of meat is used elsewhere. I was talking about this yesterday, actually. The piece of meat is used in a certain sutta to talk about sense pleasures and the danger of sense pleasures. And in that sutta, the piece of meat is like there's a bird which gets hold of a piece of meat. And because it has a piece of meat which all the other birds want as well, they attack this bird, right? So the bird flies up with a piece of meat and the other bird attacks it from all sides. And unless it gives up that piece of meat, it will obviously be very problematic for that first bird. And sensual desires are a bit like that. They're like a piece of meat. There is a limit to the pleasures in the world. There's a limit to the sense object. There's a limit to the resources in the world. And we are fighting over things, right? So the birds are fighting. In the same way, we also tend to fight over things in life. As long as there is delight, there is lust, there is attachment to worldly things, and there is a limitation on how much we can have, and other people want the same thing, we're going to fight over things. We fight over the same partners, right? The same husband and wife. We fight over job promotions. We fight whatever. There is an enormous amount of fighting going on. We fight over the oil in the Middle East, right? A lot of wars are caused by delight and lust in this way. A lot of the problems in the world come from our desire. Actually, there's other things as well. But a lot of it comes from the sense of lust and desire for things, whereby we are competing and trying to get the same things, basically. That's a piece of meat, the symbol for the delight and lust. Usually, the piece of meat is a symbol for the five chords of sense pleasure we just saw before. But here, delight and lust, perhaps, is just another way of saying the same thing. Perhaps. So throw it out. Throw out the delight and lust. And here, delight and lust here. Usually the word delight and lust is much broader than the five chords of sense pleasure. Delight and lust here includes delight and lust for absolutely everything, right? Even for the mind. Even for exalted states of mind. Everything is included. And if you abandon all delight and lust is not a good word, all delight and desire, then of course, that you actually reached full awakening, because it's actually the ending of craving itself that you get at that point. So everything is abandoned. Out with it. Chuck it out. And then that's what this is about. So now we come into the very end. Now we come into the Naga serpent. The Naga serpent is what remains at the bottom of this termite mound. That's what I was saying before. Sometimes apparently you have serpents or snakes. Apparently can live in termite mounds, so it seems. So I have been told anyway. And this might be the symbol here. So the Naga serpent, or the dragon, is a symbol for a bhikkhu who has destroyed the taints, the awakened person. Leave the Naga serpent. Do not harm the dragon. Honor the dragon. This is the meaning. So when you have thrown out all the other stuff, when you abandon all the defilements of the mind, when you have given up your attachment to the five groups of existence, or the five aggregates, as it says here, when everything is out and ignorance is finally abandoned, then all that is left is the Arahant, the fully pure person, which is here called the Naga, right? The Naga in Buddhism is this idea, on the one hand, of a dragon or a serpent. On the one hand, the Naga is also used to describe like a big elephant. It's called the Naga. It's this kind of big, amazing animal, right? It's a Naga. And it can be used to mean anything which is big and powerful. And for this reason, the Arahant is also called the Naga. Not because they are scary, but because they are spiritually very powerful. When you see an Arahant, you think, wow, what amazing. Amazing that such beings can exist in the world. So that's why they're called Nagas, the Arahants, and why they are likened to these mythological creatures called the dragons or the Naga serpents. So leave the Naga. When you become an Arahant, that is fine. Then you can rest. You have come to the end of the path. There's nothing more to be done. You just let things be. You just await your time like the workman waiting for his wages, as it says in the suttas, or it says in the Theragata, the verses of Venerable Sariputta. This is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Kumara Kassapa was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Vamika Sutta Nittitanga. Any questions before we call it a day? Yes, we talk. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure. Sometimes it looks like it is meant for. Because sometimes it comes to groups, right? If it was within mind's eye, you think it would be an individual experience. But sometimes it seems to be with groups of monks coming down. And they all kind of, wow, what is that? Afterwards, they ask the Buddha, what was that light, Master, that we saw yesterday? And they go, oh, that was the Deva visiting me. Excuse me. So in those cases, it seems to be actually a physical thing. But it is possible, too, to see Devas in the mind's eye as well. That's certainly possible, and we can do that in deep meditation, in meditations. That's certainly another way of looking at it. So I would say both are probably possible ways of interpreting this. But there is an interesting argument about, excuse me, about the origin of Mahayana Buddhism and some of the suttas in Mahayana Buddhism. And some of the suttas in Mahayana Buddhism, they're very kind of florid and lots of things happening and lots of deities and lots of things happening and thousands of bodhisattvas, and you know, goes on page after page of all the wonders and marvels. And One of the things that has been suggested is that the reason how these things came about, these particular suttas, was through meditation experiences. People saw these things in meditation, just like the see a deva or something in your meditation. You actually had these visions, you know, in meditation, and then you wrote it down as a sutta afterwards. There could be a similar kind of thing, perhaps, as what we are seeing here. It could be a further development of what we're seeing, perhaps, in this situation. Yeah. Not really. No, just a random comment. I'm just trying to make sense of it. This is a suggestion that has been made of some other things that are found in the suttas, that they may have come from outside of Buddhism. And sometimes you do see that. You see that there is a general verse or something that was around at the time of the Buddha, that the Buddha then would rewrite or reinterpret in such a way that it made sense from a Buddhist point of view. So this actually happened. So it's not entirely unthinkable that may have happened, yeah. It does, doesn't it, a little bit? Some of those symbols are not seen anywhere else in the suttas, right? You don't see it anywhere else, so where does it come from if it's nowhere else? If it was somewhere else, then, well, the Buddha might have... If it came from the Buddha, you would expect to find it somewhere else. But here it comes from a deity, and then the Buddha explains it, right? So it's kind of reverse sequence, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, some of the I love the similes and the metaphors used by the Buddha. Some of them are so powerful and so incredibly strong, and they're worth a lot of reflecting, actually, the similes, because they bring things alive. And the Buddha is a master of similes. There's so many beautiful similes in there. So, yeah. Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, one of the ways is that because consciousness is divided into six types of consciousness, and you have the consciousness of each sense, the five senses, and also the consciousness of the mind, and these are distinct types of consciousness. It's very hard to see that unless you go into deep meditation, but that can be seen. So when the sight disappears completely, that aspect of consciousness is gone. So one aspect of knowing, of awareness itself, has actually disappeared. And then as you, that is really how you see these things happening. And of course, ultimately, you go to a state where all consciousness is gone, right? It's all disappeared. Yeah. That can disappear as well, yeah. In the end, that too disappears. So you have this state which is called the cessation of perception and feeling in Buddhism, where everything disappears. And you come out afterwards and you feel blissed out. That was the best experience you ever had. Everything was gone. Yeah. It's kind of paradoxical. That's why these things are so profound. Sometimes you wonder, this is just really, really strange stuff. Yeah. Okay. Everybody happy here? Yeah. Okay. So let's pay our respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.